Dr. McCary, welcome back to Smarter News.
Welcome to the FDA, Jenna.
Yeah, this is very exciting to be here. I was thinking back on how many years we've done interviews together.
Gosh.
In a lot of different settings.
Yes.
I know. Our most recent one was in 2021. We're going to talk a little bit about that. So we've had a couple years, but it's the first time at the FDA, and congratulations with your role.
Well, thanks a lot. Now, you're kind of a pioneer in journalism. You've been in the business for a while, and you're doing your own thing, and I'm glad to see it so successful.
Well, thank you. I was doing it before it was cool, Dr. McCary.
You were doing it. Cool.
How's the job going? How do you like this position?
It's great. It's a tremendous responsibility. You know, the FDA regulates 20% of the U.S. economy, and it's everything. It's mangoes coming across the borders. It's CAT scan machines. It's tobacco products and what's in vape stores. It's drugs and devices and wearables. So it's a massive organization. It's right here. This is the FDA. You can see our scientists are diligently working right now. We have a great culture, a great community. They're setting up the farmers market, if people can see that. So it's a great place to work.
Well, word on the street from my limited time in the FDA is that you actually really like the cafeteria. Is that true?
Well, I've always said I love the hospital cafeteria, not because of the food in hospitals. It's pretty pathetic, actually, but because I could interact with patients and other doctors, and it was a sort of social retreat. So here's the same thing. This is the opportunity I have to meet so many of the staff and pharmacists and docs at the FDA is in the cafeteria.
Well, that's where I want to do my next investigative report, because I really want to see, you know, what's actually in the FDA cafeteria.
It's much healthier. Okay. Yeah, we've made major changes.
You know, I know we have a lot of topics to cover today. We're going to cover a lot of ground. So I'm very grateful to talk to you this week. Some topics we expected, some are new topics that just came up in the news. But I was thinking about this as we were driving here, how journalism and healthcare share a common problem, which is a lack of trust from the public.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years at Smarter News, I've talked about how we can report a story perfectly, but still miss the point.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the central tenets that I want to talk about today is really about public trust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what we're trying to solve with Smarter News, a solution in news. And I know that's something really important to you that we've talked over the years. So I want to talk first about trust and then get to some of the hot topics.
Yeah.
We're going to do something a little bit different.
Okay.
Why did you turn to medicine in the first place? What brought you into medicine?
Well, look, nowhere else can you have an intense bond with somebody you've never met before, because they have this phenomenal trust in your profession that has historically put others first. It's had an incredibly selfless culture to it. I saw my dad get a big hug in the grocery store from a random person. It turns out it was his patient for 10 years. He managed him through leukemia. And you see that bond. You see how thankful and grateful people are. And the way that we can also bring in the magnificence of modern science and make it personally, to me, that's the most beautiful thing in the world. For someone you've never met before to trust you to put a knife to their skin or tell you secrets they would never tell their spouse within seconds of meeting you, it's a special, incredible relationship. And so I think we have to preserve that and we have to respect it.
Was there a moment that you remember growing up where you thought, this is going to be my path? I'm going to turn to surgery. This is where I really feel called.
Well, I mean, I did surgery because I thought I wanted to be a missionary doctor.
No kidding.
Yeah. And people said, If you want to go into missions work, surgery is the residency to do, because the other stuff you can learn. You can read in the books. You can learn on the fly. Not that it's easy, but you know, the technical skills, you have to get trained in the technical skills. So I went into surgery. I ended up, you know, I left medical school after my third year a little disillusioned. I felt like we weren't really making a difference. We weren't looking holistically. We weren't talking about food as medicine and gut health and the microbiome and all of these areas that were being ignored, these giant blind spots in modern medicine. So I enrolled in the School of Public Health, got a graduate degree in public health. I loved it.
And that's in Harvard.
At Harvard, right? The Harvard School of Public Health. I missed the clinical bedside care and eventually came back to clinical medicine.
Well, we have sometimes different paths.
Yes.
To the end goal. And so where did you wind up as a clinician for your practice?
So I was I became fellowship trained in surgical oncology, that is cancer surgery, and gastrointestinal surgery. But my time at Johns Hopkins was really especially in the last 7-8 years, was dominated by research. I spent most of my time with research grants studying big questions that crossed different specialties. And I'd have colleagues tell me, you know, they'd often tease me and say, I see you're doing a project with the OB doctors. Now you're doing a project with the ophthalmologists. Like, you're all over the place. What are you doing? And I was just, you know, I thought, I'm intellectually curious. I just think there's so much cool stuff. And you can't really prepare for a job like this at the FDA, but it ended up being a good background.
Yeah, that's, again, interesting to see these different paths. I read that you actually did some novel surgical operations, that you were some of the first of a set of doctors to do these operations. What were they?
So my team and I did the first series of laparoscopic pancreas islet transplant operations. And we did it because we did it for a subset of patients with a chronic pain condition called chronic pancreatitis. But we thought it may be a path to a cure for diabetes. And so we felt like if we can master this field and allow the technology to improve, we could be at the forefront of that. And I'm still very optimistic that we may see a cure for type 1 diabetes in the not too distant future.
Really? Why do you believe that?
I think the way in which islets now, this, that is the cells that produce the insulin, they're now able to be developed outside the body and even genetically modified. Some believe that it can be modified in a way that prevents it being rejected in the body. And so if we can get beyond that step where we can actually start to grow islets outside the body and have them accepted by another individual without them being rejected, it could be very promising.
Well, it sounds like you're still very passionate about the work that you've done in the past. Was it hard to leave some of that behind to come to the FDA? How did that happen where suddenly, well, now you're sitting here as FDA commissioner?
It was hard. And look, it was like a night and day. One day I was in the operating room at Johns Hopkins, about 45 minutes up the street here from the FDA. And the next day, literally the next day, I was in front of the Senate for my confirmation hearing.
And I think just was, all in a day's work, Dr. McCurry.
It was just a big transition. But look, it's made me passionate to streamline the agency. We've got to modernize what we're doing. Why does it take 10 to 12 years for a new drug to come to market? It's literally insane, and it's a barrier for people to get meaningful cures and treatments. So we are trying to modernize that process. We have a new program to get decisions out in weeks on new drugs instead of about a year. And we're going to keep innovating and trying new things because we've got to modernize this process. And we're going to prioritize drugs that are the most exciting. It's not going to be as if all applications are received equally. If an application is for a drug that meets a large unmet public health need or involves manufacturing in the United States, which is a national security issue, or the company is going to make the drugs affordable, or it meets one of our big national priorities, then we're going to give it priority review.
I was interested to see what exactly the FDA does. And it was interesting to review that as we talk about it so much, but just thinking about what falls under your umbrella. So I'm going to read this for our audience. The FDA is responsible for protecting the public health by ensuring the safety, efficacy, and security of human and veterinarian drugs, biological products, and medical devices, and by ensuring the safety of our nation's food supply, cosmetics, and products that emit radiation. And one part of the website, it says, from mammograms to microwaves, which I feel like really covers a broad portion of my life, Dr. McCurry. But that's a really big umbrella. What do you see as the biggest challenge facing the FDA right now? Is it the speed of approval of medications, or is it something else?
Look, I think it's delivering more cures and meaningful treatments for the American people and healthier food for children, and then safeguarding against hazards. We have vape shops popping up on every corner in America, and there are a lot of illegal Chinese vape products sold in those stores. So we've got to do our job to safeguard the public and at the same time hold to our tried and true mission of making sure that claims of products, including drugs and devices, match the data that is being submitted to support those claims.
Yeah, very interesting. We're going to talk some about that because I was curious to learn about what was available to me in America as a woman in my 40s and what my child can encounter at a convenience store and how you have to really watch both of these things for obvious reasons. You had some big announcements this week regarding children and autism. One of the most important parts of the announcement this week was about the treatment that you're moving to make more accessible for children already with autism, which is a drug I'm not familiar with. Can you tell us a little bit about it and why you felt it was important to move forward with that now?
Well, first of all, we had a charge to look into autism, and this is something important to the president. If you look at the rates of autism, they've skyrocketed in our generation. A generation ago, it was rare for anyone to have autism. Just look at people with these repetitive motions and tics and individuals completely nonverbal. You don't see anyone in their 60s or 70s who has those autism symptoms that has had them from birth. But now you see this explosion to the point where now it's 1 in 12 boys in California will have some symptoms along the autism spectrum. Now, some of it is increased diagnoses, but it is an epidemic, and it's a cruel medical condition for some kids. You see a young kid getting frustrated and angry and crying because they want to talk back. They feel like they don't have the words. And so we've got to do something. And so we have been doing an analysis of the potential mechanisms of autism and identified one that is fairly mature that we decided to make it public, and that is a autoimmune condition by which the folate receptor is blocked at the blood-brain barrier, prohibiting the vitamin folate, that is B9, from entering the brain. And so these kids don't have enough folate in their brain. The neurons are starving of folate. And so it's affecting neural development most likely.
Now, did you see that was autoimmune related or an autoimmune response?
It's autoimmune. Probably in 20 to 50% of kids, you can actually see a positive antibody if you test for the antibody.
And so correct me if I'm pronouncing this wrong, leucovorin is the treatment. So what does leucovorin do then?
So doctors have noticed that if they give leucovorin, which has been around for nearly a century, it can bypass that blocked receptor and get methylated folate into the brain. And so doctors have noticed if they test, say, all the kids that come to them with autism, maybe half will have the antibody showing the blocked, you know, suggesting the receptor is blocked. And 20% of the whole group of kids may have a marked improvement with leucovorin. And another 20 to 30% may have some sort of improvement.
Does it like open up that pathway so the folate can come in? Is that what it does?
Yeah, it bypasses it. It allows folate to go directly in, and it bypasses the need for a receptor because it's hydrophobic and hydrophilic, so it can go directly through the membrane.
I'm curious about the mechanism. There's some that say part of the reason why we have higher rates of autism is because the spectrum has widened and we're looking for it now, and other conditions, maybe we're catching more in the dragnet of looking for it.
I think that's true, but we're also seeing more severe autism, and that's deeply concerning.
Who's the ideal patient for this treatment?
So doctors who have a large experience treating kids with leucovorin say that they will typically start with the antibody test, and of those who test positive for the antibody, most of the kids will see an improvement. In one study of kids with autism and a folate deficiency, that is documented folate deficiency, two-thirds had some improvement with leucovorin.
How quickly can they start seeing it?
I mean, I've heard as early as a few weeks. I think a lot of doctors will stop the leucovorin if after 6 weeks to a few months, there's no improvement.
How expensive is it? How accessible is it?
Well, it's generic. It's out there. We are started the process to have the official label include cerebral folate deficiency in the label. So it's available.
Interesting. So I was looking at the Wall Street Journal. They interviewed Dr. Jesty, the chief neurologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. And she said that she's heard of this, but she doesn't want to prescribe it. And she hasn't wanted to prescribe it because she's concerned about long-term side effects that she feels haven't been studied enough, that she wanted a rigorous, reproducible, randomized controlled trial, which we know is the gold standard. What do you say to those that may see this sort of response and say, well, we're pushing this through too fast, and really this, and as she's calling it, says it's a slippery slope, because if we let this treatment through, maybe we let other things that also don't have the oversight that we need, especially when it comes to our kids.
Look, some doctors may not be comfortable in this space. We never talk about this in medical school, ever. And so here you have an epidemic.
You mean autism?
Autism. Or the mechanisms that have been described in the literature in different studies. Talk to doctors. 9 out of 10 will tell you they've never heard of any treatments for autism. It turns out there's a randomized controlled trial in the Journal of the American Medical Association with another potential treatment that showed promise. Now, it's one study. There's also a mechanism of mitochondrial dysfunction, if you will. And then there's this autoimmune mechanism. So there may be multiple mechanisms. The microbiome may play a role. We know 90% of the body's serotonin comes from the gut. And so there's a powerful connection between the mind and the gut. And that's just one molecule. So we're starting to peel back and learn more and more. But there comes a point where we feel like we need to at least make information available to doctors. Because while there are some doctors who are not familiar with this, have never heard of it, just may be uncomfortable, there are a group of doctors who have seen thousands of kids with autism and are reporting some pretty impressive data.
Is that sort of trial that she's describing in the works?
A randomized controlled trial. So the NIH announced just recently that they're going to fund 13 major studies on autism, totaling $50 million in new funding. And that's what we need. We've had a ton of money going to cancer and heart disease. We've not been studying basic things about what we eat or novel pathways or treatments that are considered cutting edge, but no company would invest in it because leucovorin is already generic. Mm. And so repurposed drugs tend to not get the attention as new branded drugs when they could potentially help conditions that are increasing.
Very fascinating, and obviously a quickly moving field of study. The other part of your announcement, while some have experience with autism, a lot of us have experience with Tylenol. And you talked about the label changing for leucovorin, but there was also an announcement potentially of another warning. And let me just read it, because I think actually reading your work back to you so that we're all on the same page, because I know there's a lot of information has come out on this. The actual announcement that you sent to physicians about acetaminophen use during pregnancy says this: while an association between acetaminophen and autism has been described in many studies, a causal relationship has not been established, and there are contrary studies in the scientific literature. The association is an ongoing area of scientific debate, and clinicians should be aware of the issue in their clinical decision-making, especially given the most short-term fevers in pregnant women and young children do not require medication. The question about acetaminophen and autism and the relationship between the two is not new, to especially those that have someone with autism in their family. But it was new to a lot of moms this week that this was even thought of. You know, this is something I had never heard of as a mom of three. So why this warning now?
Well, so Harvard and Mount Sinai did a review of all the existing studies, and they looked at 27 studies that found an association between prenatal acetaminophen use and subsequent autism. Now, as we acknowledged there, the research is mixed, but they did report in that study that the higher quality studies favored an association and the lower quality studies found no association. So we felt a duty to inform. We are letting doctors know about this body of information. You know, some people have very strong feelings about this. If you talk to the dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, he has gone on record to say that there is a causal relationship between prenatal acetaminophen use and autism. He feels very strongly about that relationship. Ultimately, as we've said, with disclaimers that it depends on an individual circumstance. There are exceptions, and it is up to a doctor and their patient. We just don't want to see people feel like you have to treat every low-grade fever because that's required. It's not. As a matter of fact, with kids that develop fevers for things like a common illness, research has actually shown out of Johns Hopkins, my former institution, that if you treat a child's fever during the course of illness, you prolong the illness, the duration of symptoms, because the fever may be the body's natural way of ridding the infection.
I'm thinking about all the moms out there that are heading into flu season.
Yeah.
And I know that in my medicine cabinet, I have a whole bunch of stuff just in case, because everyone knows what it's like to wake up in the middle of the night with a sick kid with a really high fever. And although you may hesitate giving them any medicine because you want to let them, you know, work through it, sometimes you need to.
Yeah, look, sometimes the kids are uncomfortable and we don't want to see kids uncomfortable.
How do you navigate that though? How would you, I know everyone has to talk to their doctor and yeah. I think it's important to remind them about that. But what do you say to the American moms out there that are like, so now should I not give my child any Tylenol ever? How do I think through that?
I think some basic principles. When you give a antipyretic, something to lower the fever, you're not treating the illness. You're not helping the child get better faster. And people need to know that. A low-grade fever is different from a high-grade fever. We don't want to see kids go into a state of being very uncomfortable. But the idea that, there's kid has a temperature of 99.8, therefore I gave a Tylenol, you're not, what are you doing? Like, we have this sort of reactionary, I saw it in the hospital all the time. I get a call from the nurse, Marty, your patient has a fever of 100.7. I went ahead and gave Tylenol, and I'm thinking, why? What are you treating? Like, what are we doing? Was the patient uncomfortable? I don't think at 100.7. So low-grade fevers, we don't need to be giving any antipyretic willy-nilly.
What was interesting about this announcement is typically we may not get a government announcement about an association. Was it the recent studies from Harvard and other places that you felt it rose to the level where you wanted kind of an all government with the president there? Press conference about it or press announcement?
Well, the press announcement was also about leucovorin, and I think that is a message that everybody should know about so they can have a conversation with the doctor who is comfortable with leucovorin, who sees a lot of kids with autism, and learn about this potential treatment option. That is a good news story, and I think that is a big message. We do this kind of stuff at the FDA all the time. There's a safety concern, and so we'll modify the label a little bit.
You know, what is that going to look like, by the way? Because I actually have a bottle of... can I grab it out of my purse? Is that okay?
You can grab it.
Okay, so it's funny. I have a little medical kit that I travel with. I don't really look at it that often. But I was getting ready today. I was like, look at what's in my kit, Tylenol. Not opened. But then I thought, okay, well, let me see what the warnings are. Wait, hold on. Hold on. And I know this is just a mini case, okay? Maybe I need glasses, Dr. McCary. Anywhere in the FDA can get one of those? Yes. So there's the warnings for liver, warnings about taking too many too soon, you know, do not use with other drugs. You go back to, you know, down to the bottom, stop using, blah, blah, blah. If pregnant or breastfeeding, ask a health professional before use. So what would be what will I see new added to this based on your announcement?
Yeah, you know, some sentence or phrase suggesting that there's some information here about this potential association. We have a formal process with our career scientists here at the FDA to ensure that it's impeccably accurate and doesn't overstate what's in the literature. So they're gonna start that process.
Okay.
But this is something we do all the time. There are drug-drug interactions. There are new things that we discover after a drug is approved, even generics. And so we're always modifying labels a little bit like that. I don't know who's actually gonna read it.
Well, today I did. And sometimes you do read it and you think, wow, I didn't know about that. That's quite a warning. So that's good. We'll stay close on that and see when that new warning comes into effect. And also follow leucovorin, which is a fascinating new area of study. Speaking of associations, we're going to kind of switch topics now. There in the past was an association that wasn't, or that many have been critical of. We can talk about this. An association between hormone replacement therapy and estrogen specifically and breast cancer came out of a big study many, many years ago and has been the common thought. This was the topic of conversation of a panel that the FDA held recently. And I have to admit to you, some of what was discussed on this panel, I had never heard about. And I exist in the world as a woman, and hormones are a major part of my life, Dr. Yeah. McCary. I mean, quite frankly speaking. So talk to us a little bit about why hormone replacement therapy was one of the first topics that you tackled as the new head of the FDA.
I solved a big snack problem in our household in a very simple way. My children love eating berries, and so do I, for not just the taste, but the vitamins and nutrients, fiber, all the good stuff we want on a regular basis. The problem? We all know what it's like to pick up a berry we just bought, and it's already growing fuzz in the fridge. So I've switched to buying frozen berries. And a favorite I look for now is Washington Red Raspberries. Did you know 90% of frozen red raspberries in the United States are grown in Washington State, and mostly grown on family farms who harvest them during peak ripeness and clean and freeze on location, sealing in all that freshness, taste, and great nutritional value. So now I use frozen raspberries in our yogurt or smoothies as a sweet treat, and I love that this means I can support local American farmers and have a healthy snack for my family that withstands the test of time. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at your local grocery store or Costco. And how do you know you're getting the good stuff? Well, you just take a peek at the packaging and look for product of the U.S., and then you'll know you're on the right path. Oh, and if you want some fun recipes and more information, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. And you're going to find recipes, health tips, retail locations, everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine. Overall, it's just a smarter choice.
Well, the topic's been dominated by misinformation that's not supported by data. And there probably is no single medical intervention that can improve the health of women at a population level more than hormone replacement therapy when started before age 60, that is within 10 years of the onset of perimenopause. The long-term health benefits are tremendous. And we tend to just think about the short-term benefits, that is alleviating the symptoms of perimenopause, the hot flashes, the brain fog, night sweats, dryness. There's 50 plus symptoms of perimenopause. And people have downplayed hormone therapy thinking, oh, well, you know, women need to get over their symptoms. And if this helps them a little bit, maybe then it's okay. Well, just not only are those symptoms massively misunderstood by the medical establishment. You know, I was taught in medical school that some women have perimenopausal symptoms, it lasts a couple years, and they're usually mild. Well, the average duration of symptoms is 8 to 10 years. 80% of women have symptoms, and they're often severe. I mean, marriages get destroyed, all kinds of very debilitating symptoms. Tragically, just think about the sort of the brain fog and the cognitive decline. A woman is more likely to be prescribed an antidepressant for perimenopausal symptoms in America today than they are hormone replacement therapy. And one of the reasons is that doctors have been ingrained with a dogma that it increases the woman's risk of breast cancer mortality when no clinical trial has ever shown that hormone replacement therapy started before age 60 increases breast cancer mortality. So if we can get beyond that dogma, tell people the truth, which is what you saw, in my opinion, many of our experts do at the FDA expert roundtable that we held a few months into my coming into office, we can start talking about the tremendous long-term health benefits. The number one cause of death in women in the United States is heart disease. Hormone therapy has been found to reduce the risk of fatal heart attacks by 25 to 50%. I mean, statins don't even hit some of those numbers, and we're pushing statins all the time. Bone strength, cognitive decline. One study found a 35% reduced risk of Alzheimer's. And so women live longer and feel better on hormone replacement therapy.
It's interesting when we talk about women's health, we get very narrow focused into what the symptoms are for the woman, not thinking as well, what is the effect on the entire family? As you mentioned, what's the effect on the marriage? What's the effect as she's embracing motherhood at the time or not? It doesn't really matter. What is it like for her at work? And there seems to have been a dismissal of some of these symptoms that you're describing as something that she should just tough out and get through. And if you don't have a serious health issue, you know, if you're not really showing a heart problem or you don't have, you know, really you're getting lost on the way home because you're so disoriented, well, then you don't really get that. I actually had a doctor once tell me, oh, well, you know, it's too hard to look at hormones just because they change all the time. That's actually tragic. What was an exact quote from a doctor. So, you know, if that's what you're getting when you're talking about symptoms, That's a hard thing to navigate if you don't have a medical background.
The medical field bought hook, line, and sinker the concept that it was going to increase breast cancer mortality in 2002. Women got calls from their doctors, hey, this new study just came out, which, by the way, came out in the media before it came out in the medical literature. When you go into the study, as I've described.
Well, and this is actually something we should talk about more in depth. Maybe not today, but I think it's a very interesting, it's not just about the study, which was some information that was extrapolated that was wrong. It was also that the way that journalists presented the information also was misleading. So you had two different things happening at the same time, and it shows you the power of a story to last, to have legs for decades, if it's not immediately corrected or more context provided.
And the power of fear. I mean, when you dangle fear around something as sensitive as breast cancer to women.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, the fear machine took over. And it took over in the minds of doctors, too, because the reality is that doctors get their information from television as well sometimes, and that this just became a dogma. It had big branded institutions behind the so-called study, even though if you dive deep into the study, there was no statistically significant increase in breast cancer in the original 2002 study. But 80% of women flushed their pills down the toilet or ripped off their patches, and it became this taboo thing. All of a sudden, this miracle intervention for so many women was now a carcinogen in their minds. And tragically, to this day, you talk to 7 out of 10 doctors about hormone replacement therapy, they'll tell you, ooh, I worry about that breast cancer thing. I've had hour-long conversations with doctors, and in the end, they're like, I had no idea that's what the data actually shows.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's very interesting. And I have a family history of breast cancer. So I also know that it is nuanced. There are conversations to have about hormones. Let's talk about warning labels, because we talked about the warning label for Tylenol.
Right.
What about the estrogen comes in a lot of different forms, a lot of different hormone replacement therapies in general. But there was a lot of conversation in this panel, and our audience was very curious about this, about black box warnings. Is that the same as a warning I would see on a container of Tylenol, or is
no,
it something different?
It's
why
different.
Does that matter?
It is a big banner warning, sort of a very, like an alert that says, warning, this can cause blank or blank. And it's on all the different types of estrogen, the systemic estrogen and the topical estrogen. So the fear machine of 2002 has done not only tremendous damage in scaring off women and doctors from considering this amazing therapy, but also it's resulted in the FDA reacting in the groupthink and putting these black box warnings. So when a doctor says, hey, I've evaluated your situation, you don't have a contraindication because there are some rare contraindications, I recommend starting hormone replacement therapy, then you pick it up from the pharmacy and you see this black box warning. And so it's fueled this sort of fear machine out there. So the FDA is taking a strong look at removing the black box warnings on estrogen.
What do you think the impact of that would be?
Well, look, I think people are starting to come around that it does not increase breast cancer mortality, that the fear machine resulted in groupthink 23 years ago, that may have represented one of the biggest mistakes of modern medicine, depriving 50 million women of a therapy that allows them to feel healthier, live longer, be far less likely to break a bone if they trip or fall or get into a car accident later in life. You know, when you get to age 80, a woman has a high risk of a hip fracture. It's like 1 in 3 women. And so when you have a therapy that results in stronger bones, that fights osteoporosis, you're far less likely to have a hip fracture. Well, that's a common cause of death in older women. So it is an incredible public health tool that doctors want to use, but we have to get over the fear machine.
So you're saying that removing the black box warning would be both beneficial for patients and for practitioners, because it removes a very visible reminder of an association that you and others don't believe is there.
That's right. It since there's no increase in breast cancer mortality, what are we doing? We are, of course, going to include all the data deep in the label that it comes with the medication, so they can look at the odds ratio and get as wonky as they want on the details about breast cancer and the effect size. But to suggest that it increases breast cancer mortality, which the black box labels do in, you know, front and center, I think it's done a tremendous disservice. I think the entire topic has been treated terribly by the medical profession, by the establishment, by the media. And I think we owe it to women to get the truth out so they can make their own decisions.
It's challenging. I think about that time, 2 decades, really, of a common belief. This is still the black box warning that we're talking about. We're still talking about estrogen cream. What about systemic estrogen?
Same thing.
That the black box warning, the FDA is taking a look at that?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, and it's because people have sent us letters saying, this is scaring away my patients, and I'm trying to give them a therapy that makes sense. Now, whether or not you add progestin to the estrogen depends on whether or not a woman still has a uterus. If they do have a uterus, then it's highly recommended that you also take progestin to prevent endometrial hyperplasia or maybe even endometrial cancer. This needs to be managed by a clinician. But we have heard over and over again that the demonization of hormone replacement therapy with the attitude that just have women suffer, ignoring the long-term benefits. I mean, just the reduction in cognitive decline is up to 65%. So you're talking about the health of a population. And up to 1 in 4 middle-aged women in the United States are taking treatment for depression. Well, can we get at the root cause? Estrogen is a hormone naturally made by the body. It just drops off its natural production at a certain age. So we're talking about continuing a body's natural hormone.
As you're talking, I'm thinking about medical dogma, which is a term that you brought up during this panel that really sat with me, because I thought, what does Dr. McCary really mean by that? And how tough is that to change? What do you mean by medical dogma? Because it seems that what you're describing here is this groupthink about hormone therapy for women. How difficult is it to provide a different perspective and to get people on board?
You know, I was telling you earlier, my time at Johns Hopkins and in the cafeteria doing research across so many different specialties, I learned a lot. I learned there are some common themes in every one of the 84 major specialties in medicine. Every specialty has its medical dogma. It has assumptions that many doctors in the field need to be challenged. And so one of those things is medical dogma. So we demonized natural saturated fat as a medical profession. For 50 years, we got that wrong. We gave the American Academy of Pediatrics gave the wrong guidance on how to prevent peanut allergies in children, telling them to avoid peanut butter until they were age 3. That was the wrong guidance. Turns out that didn't reduce your risk of peanut allergies. It increases the risk of peanut allergies and may explain why we have a peanut allergy epidemic today because of 15 years of dogma. And so opioids are non-addictive. For 17 years, that was dogma. So we've had an epidemic of medical dogma. It can take on a life of its own. And the way we fight medical dogma is with good data.
Is the science ever settled? I hear that term.
No,
now,
I don't.
Right? Like science, the science is settled. The consensus says this. You hear that a lot with health stories these days. And as a journalist, sometimes it's very difficult to navigate that because I want to acknowledge consensus and also embrace curiosity. Because good journalism does both of those things.
Yes. And good science does both of those things. Yeah, I think that we've seen a lot of convenient arguments crop up, especially in the era of COVID, to sort of censor or silence different opinions. And the public now sees the dogma we saw during COVID of cloth masks on toddlers for nearly 3 years, covering the face of a young child with a cloth mask, ignoring natural immunity. That was a terrible mistake. It created distrust. Pushing COVID boosters in young, healthy kids, ignoring myocarditis in young men. So we even saw a recent version of that sort of groupthink in medicine. I think you fight bad ideas with more ideas. It's good to have a disagreement. Controversy is good. We can have a discussion among experts. I think it's okay for the public to see that discussion. In the case of hormone replacement therapy, I love it when somebody gets deep in the data. I try to explain all the data on this topic in a recent piece I wrote. Because I think, I've had patients that have said, doc, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. And other people say, I want to understand this better. And the question is, science settled? Well, there comes a point as a surgeon where you have to make a decision with the information that's available. So you can't say, look, this is, I'm only going to use settled science. Most of what we do in medicine is discretionary. But you get to a point where you have to make a decision.
Yeah, it's interesting. In an interview recently, you said medicine is an art, which I think is an interesting description, because most would say, well, it's a science. Yeah. But one of the things we've learned through the pandemic is that it is changing. There's a lot of changes, and sometimes that change can be uncomfortable. I have to ask you about testosterone really quick, because I know we talked a lot about estrogen.
Yeah.
But I heard this in the panel, and I was just so surprised that there's no FDA-approved dose of testosterone for women in America. Is that true?
Well, what the concern was that came up in the panel is that it's still a Schedule III controlled substance because of the 1980s doping scandals. And so this
Are they worried about women just like going a little too far? Is that where it's kind
of... I guess that was the original concern at the time. So we're looking at that. We're looking at that issue. Studies now are showing benefit to low-dose testosterone in men and women after a certain age. And so here you have something that may have a clinical cardiac benefit, because testosterone is known to generally increase muscle mass, and part of that is the mass of the heart muscle. And so a stronger heart is a good thing, and studies are now supporting some of that.
So what are your thoughts on all the different sort of health businesses that have popped up that provide hormones to people through compounding pharmacies, because it's not a typical or traditional prescription for something like testosterone?
Well, you know, there's a wide range of suppliers out there, and it's not as simple as this is where I pick up my testosterone. It's often an injectable. It can be given as a pellet or a cream. You may not get all your options at one particular place that tends to do it just one way. So you really want an astute clinician to be able to provide the options, and I think also do some blood work to make sure that you benefit from it.
So is the FDA also working on that topic as well for women?
We do oversee. So we are looking into testosterone, absolutely, yes. We also have jurisdiction over compounding pharmacies and online pharmacies. Online pharmacies in general, and most of them are very good actors, but some of them have been marketing drugs with no mention of side effects. So it's unfair to pharmaceutical companies that have very stringent regulations that they have to state the pros and cons when you run a pharmaceutical ad. And so some of the online pharmacies have said, you know what, we're just not going to do that. They've been brazen. You may have seen the Super Bowl ad for, I think it was Hims and Hers, where they're parading around a medicine with no mention of side effects. And there are side effects that people need to be aware of. We are increasing our enforcement action on direct-to-consumer pharmaceutical ads, online pharmacies advertising pharmaceutical products, and paid social media influencers paid by pharmaceutical companies to promote drugs. You know, I realized the FDA had become increasingly lax on the topic of pharma ads, to the point where now they flood the airwaves, and it was rare. When we were growing up, you'd rarely see a pharma ad. Well, the FDA used to take enforcement action. They used to send 100-plus letters a year when they would monitor ads that this didn't meet the regulation. It was creating a quote-unquote misleading impression, which you cannot do per our regulations. Well, in 2023, 2 years ago, the FDA only sent one enforcement letter. And last year, I found out they sent zero. Well, I've been in the job about 5 months or so. So a few weeks ago, I sent out 100-plus enforcement letters and another 1,500 letters to the industry warning them that we're going to take these actions very seriously on pharmaceutical ads.
What about legislation just to outlaw pharmaceutical ads in general?
Yeah, so there's been bipartisan legislation. It's never been passed, but it's been proposed, co-sponsored by people like Bernie Sanders and Roger Marshall.
Yeah, I'm always so curious to know that other countries don't have that because it's so pervasive here. I was actually telling our team as I was getting ready for this interview, sometimes I jump on the treadmill and watch, you know, live YouTube. That's my new thing, Dr. McCary. I try to get my steps in.
Good.
I'm trying to get in my work at the same time. Sometimes it's a news show. Sometimes it's trash television. I can't say everything is super intellectual. However, every ad is the same because they're repeated in this way. I either have an ad for Botox, an ad for an antidepressant, or an ad for
psoriatic arthritis.
GLP-1s.
Yes.
And I wonder why I get off the treadmill feeling a little discouraged, you know?
I give up. I'll take it. I don't know what it is. I'll take it.
It's like, I get it. I've been being targeted, you know? But to your point, they are very pervasive, and I don't know who actually checks what's out there. And I know it's been a conversation for years about pulling those ads off. So we'll see what legislation comes up. Just really quick, just want to finish that point. The FDA is looking at very seriously those black box warnings on estrogen is a matter of priority. And you believe that the life for my daughter, when I think about healthcare for my daughter, she's 9, it could look dramatically different than the healthcare I'm receiving right now in my 40s as her mother.
Yes, women deserve good information. Historically, issues of women's health have been underappreciated, underrecognized, and have been loaded with more medical dogma. And so I believe very passionately that women deserve the right information. That's why we are re-examining the black box warnings. It's why one of my first actions was to have the panel on hormone replacement therapy for perimenopausal women. It's still a decision between a patient and their doctor, but gosh, the potential public health benefits are overwhelming.
Yeah.
You know, my mom was one of those women who never was put on hormone therapy because the study in 22 scared the crap out of her doctor. She was never even offered it. Well, she's had 2 broken bones from falls, probably wouldn't have fractured her bones and had that disability and all that medical expense had she had the stronger bones with hormone therapy. So it is a bit personal for me as well.
Yeah, I could understand that. So we'll watch that. I was very interested to hear that it's not just for the estrogen cream, that you're looking at it for systemic estrogen as well. I think that's really big news. So we'll be paying close attention to that. It is fascinating in America what you do have access to very easily. And I was thinking about this with hormone replacement therapy versus what my preteen son can walk into a convenience store and get. You know, what is actually out there, whether it's, you know, what's in the energy drinks or any of the whatever is behind the counter. And you did an announcement several weeks ago about something I've never heard about, but that the FDA is saying could be the next fentanyl, but that it's actually available on store shelves. 7-OH? What in the world is that, Dr. McCary?
So concentrated synthetic 7-OH. We're not talking about the molecule that appears in the kratom plant leaf, but a synthetic concentrated version of it is increasingly sold in America, and it is an opioid. It binds to the opioid receptor, and we need to get the word out there so that people know that you can walk into these vape stores, which are all over America now, and buy an opioid like you buy a cup of coffee.
How is that possible, though? Where are they even coming from?
It's a novel compound in its synthetic form. It has been off the radar. In the last administration, there was really no mention of it. It wasn't legal or illegal. It was sort of in that gray zone. So we have initiated the scheduling process to treat it like a controlled substance in its concentrated form. And we want parents to talk to their kids about the vaping epidemic in children today. You know, we have a lot of kids now who are vaping regularly. And it's not vaping because they've transitioned from combustible cigarettes where you have less harm. It's vaping from scratch. And so we want people to be aware of the health concerns.
That 7-OH, though, is it only taken through vaping, or can it come in liquid form? Can it come in a pill?
Oh, it's actually a pill, or it's in drinks or gummies sold in some of these shops.
And is it listed as 7-OH? Is that how you've seen it?
Sometimes it's listed as 7-OH. Other names that it goes by are hydroxymetragenine, or just metragenine, or nicknamed MIT. Now, you'll see different concentrations. Sometimes it's just ground up kratom from the kratom plant. That's not our focus. We're concerned about concentrated 7-OH. And you will see it sometimes by the name hydroxy.
So does the FDA have, is it investigators that go out and try to find where it is or who's distributing it? How do you shut that down? Or it's not at that process yet. You have to go through a regulatory process?
Look, we kind of just recently discovered this. So we are working closely with all branches of government on this. We're trying to educate people, and we initiated the controlled substance scheduling of 7-OH. We don't have any research on it. We don't know how many kids are using it. We've heard stories of a child found at their bedside dead with 2 wrappers of 7-OH. We had one parent tell us that the individual had struggled with addiction years in the past, got down to almost nothing, was just using a vape pen, and then in a vape store was sort of sold hydroxy for anxiety. And because of this individual's history with addiction, they did have some anxiety. Well, it ended up being a fatal dose. We also may be attributing some deaths to fentanyl when it could be 7-OH or this hydroxy.
One of the interesting graphs that you put out from the FDA is you showed this opioid curve, you showed the fentanyl curve, and then you show it for this. What is the mechanism in it that makes you so concerned about it versus all the other things that are out there?
7-OH or hydroxy binds to the opioid mu receptor 13 times more powerfully than morphine. And so the concentration may be smaller, but the binding is much more strong. So look, we need good research. We sounded the alarm on this, and we are hoping academic institutions step up. Two individuals who were addiction specialists were immediately paid by the industry and reversed their position on 7-OH, suggesting it's not bad for you. So look, this is, it gets a little dark sometimes.
And is it people in the United States producing it? Or is it coming from overseas?
It's coming from overseas, we think, and it's being brought in illegally to the United States.
Something, I wasn't aware of, and it sounds like something that all parents should pay close attention to. Yeah. I know we're short on time here, and there's so many different other topics. I could start, they're all acronyms though. SSRIs, GLP-1s, mm-hmm. I mean, there's all sorts of different things out there. And I hope that we have future interviews that we can dig into some of those as
well. Of course, you're always welcome here.
I appreciate it. What do you think for, if you're just speaking to, you know, our fellow citizens here, for you at the FDA, how do you prioritize? Because it feels like there's a lot of fires out there in a lot of different places, not just in healthcare. When you're sitting alone at your desk and you're thinking, what am I going to attack next? How do you do that? How do you make that decision?
I think we start with our nation's child chronic disease epidemic. When you have 40% of our nation's kids are sick now, they don't feel well, they're sad. When you have all these chemicals and ultra-processed foods go through their gut and their body is reacting to these chemicals that don't appear in nature, not an acute inflammatory reaction, but just a chronic low-grade reaction. They feel blah, they feel not well, and then it makes them sad. And if you look at what we're doing now to kids, we are losing that central mission to medicine to treat an individual holistically. Take a look at what we do to kids. We rattle them in the middle of the night when it's dark, not because it's good for their circadian rhythms, but because it's convenient for adults. We feed them ultra-processed foods. We raise their glycemic index. We have them sit at a desk. Then we hit them again with another ultra-processed load of highly addictive carbohydrates and nutrient-poor food. And then they have no natural light exposure. Some of these kids in school have less natural light than some inmates in a penitentiary. And then they can't sit still for 7 hours straight. And what do? We drug them at scale. And so we've got to stop at some point and ask, what are we doing? What are the root causes? So I spend a lot of time on the phone with Jay Bhattacharya, head of the NIH, and Mehmet Oz, head of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, to talk about how do we study and pay for addressing root causes. We've got to start talking about school lunch programs, not just approving insulin analogs. We've got to talk about the SNAP program, whereby the government's spending $400 million a day just on schools, and then another lump sum for the SNAP program. This is the first administration where we've said the money does not have to go to junk food and sugary drinks. We've issued SNAP waivers. To me, that is a powerful step. We've got to talk about the environmental exposures that cause cancer, not just the chemo drugs that we approve here at the FDA to treat cancer. So I think a lot about the holistic picture and about children. And I think if we start there and end there, and we can make some dent to our chronic disease epidemic, then it'll be a win.
When we talked in 2021, this may surprise you. I looked back at our interview last night, and it really brought me back to such a different time in history. We were all so focused on the pandemic, what was happening next with the virus. I mean, that feels both like recent history and like a million years ago. One of the things you said that you were concerned about was politicization of the human immune system.
Yes, it happened.
And so here you are. I mean, that was exactly, this was your number one concern. And you had said it in the way that, I wrote it down because politicization of the human immune system, think without even having to describe that, we know what that's about. We can feel that. And this is where we have that concern about who can we trust. Yes. And so I asked this question with that thought, which is, why do you believe the American public can trust you now?
Well, look, the way that they are going to rebuild public trust, not just in doctors and hospitals, but in our public health institutions, is only if we show humility. Saying, I don't know, is a reasonable answer when that's the right answer. You read our label here. We're extremely honest. I mean, we've got to show that humility. Unfortunately, we didn't see that humility.
So how do you come back from that? You know, how do you not have more politicization of the human immune system?
I think we're going to see politicization because we could literally approve the cure for cancer, and you'll have people who would say, "Well, it's too late, or it's too rushed, or some criticism." And look, bring it on. You know, I'm a surgeon. I've got tough skin. I love a healthy debate. But at some point, we have to disarm and realize we all want the same thing. If there's a pothole in a community, it's not a red or blue issue or a liberal concern. It's just a question of competence. Can you fix this problem? And if you look at our task at the FDA to deliver healthier food for children and more cures and meaningful treatments for the American public, I think one of the measures of success will be when people look back and see our food supply is safer. You know, Tyson Food last week just said they're getting rid of all the 9 petroleum-based food dyes, which most of the food industry now has agreed to when we've asked them. High fructose corn syrup. They're getting rid of titanium dioxide, the next tier of chemicals, BHT. That's a win. That's a win. On the drug side, I'd like to see a cure for some types of stage 1 and 2 GI cancers. You get to see what's in the pipeline in this job. I think that's a win. I'd like to see a meaningful treatment for PTSD. We lose 8,000 veterans a year to suicide. That's more than the entire Iraq and Afghan wars. Each year we lose them. So the wars are over, but our men and women keep dying. We owe it to them to get a decision on potentially promising treatments for PTSD. I'm committed to it. Treatments for neurodegenerative disorders, for type 1 diabetes that we discussed about my area. And I'd like to see some more universal shots, vaccines that give long-term protection against, say, influenza. If we use a data-driven approach and deliver, I think we can protect and even build on the brand of the FDA, which is one of the greatest brands in the world. My grandfather, practicing from the African continent, relied on that brand. It's a powerful brand. The people here, the scientists on this campus, are committed to that brand. So I think we have to start using some common sense.
Well, I appreciate the time today, Dr. McCary. Thank you.
Great.
So we covered a lot of ground, but I still have those other topics. So next time we'll go to the cafeteria or the farmer's market out there. Maybe we can do the interview there next. Then I really want to see what you eat in real life.
Okay, I'll be on good behavior then for you.
But Dr. McCary, thank you so much for the time today.
It's so nice
to see you
again.
Thanks
for being
here
at the FDA.
Thank you for believing in quick, concise, nonpartisan, smarter news. Every time you join us or share or save our content, you help us build a solution in news, and we are so grateful. We have a few other ways you can support our mission, from joining our insider community Scoop, to shopping our gear at our Smarter Shop, to just telling a friend. The best way to do any of this is to visit smarternews.com or follow us at Smarter News on social media. Don't worry, we put all of this in the captions so it's easy for you. Plus, we added our email just in case you want to drop us a note. We always love hearing from you. Thank you for helping us deliver news smarter.